It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll speak with a neuroscientist who discovered something surprising about what it means to have the brain of a psychopath.
First, early Sunday morning, the U.S. and five other world powers came to an unprecedented nuclear agreement with Iran. Iran will restrict its uranium enrichment to a level used for non-military production in exchange for easing some of the economic sanctions.
The agreement has a deadline of 6 months, during which further negotiations are expected. The deal has been met with praise and skepticism, with harsh criticism coming from Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu.
Here with us to talk about the details of the agreement and what we can expect in the coming months is Politico's Deputy White House Editor Rebecca Cinderbrand. Rebecca, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the agreement is being called historic. How significant is it, do you think?
Oh, it's extremely significant. You know, this is marking, it's easy to remember that just a few short months ago, it had been more than three decades since the two leaders of the United States and Iran had spoken with each other. And now there's an actual diplomatic agreement that's been reached. Granted, it's only an interim agreement, but of course, the administration pointing to it as the first step to a more permanent resolution to the problem.
So you mentioned the six-month deal. It was reached. What does it have to say about Iran's capability to develop nuclear weapons now and in the future?
Well, there's a couple of interesting things that are in it, and there's a couple of things that are still seem to be, at least at this moment, a little fuzzy and are still being resolved. Right now, what it says is Iran is going to agree to stop producing this sort of enriched uranium that basically represents the best effort to produce weapons-grade material, and it's also going to stop developing new centrifuges, which you know can produce fuel for a nuclear weapon. It's going to agree not to install critical components or fuel at its reactor at Iraq, which could produce enough plutonium for two weapons a year if it were operational, and it's going to neutralize its medium-enriched nuclear fuel and agree to some inspections. And in return, the Western powers have agreed not to impose new sanctions for the next 6 months if Iran abides by the commitment, and to allow Iran access to some of its reserves that have been frozen overseas.
And critics of this, you know, are saying, well, this is not the whole goal. We had wanted, you know, for instance, Israel saying we wanted more out of this. You haven't gone far enough. What is the United States saying about the six-month plan and maybe getting further along the pike with this?
Well, there's a couple of things here. Number one is, of course, the president can ask Congress and make the case to Congress that new sanctions shouldn't be imposed. But, of course, that's exactly what was in progress before this agreement was announced. There was discussion in Congress, even in the days leading up to this agreement's announcement, of the possibility of even stronger sanctions than the ones already in place. And that's a discussion that continues, even in the wake of this agreement. So, you know, the president and the administration have to make the case to both allies and critics on Capitol Hill that now is not the time to impose new restrictions on Iran, that they need to let the process develop.
And President Obama did not have to go to Congress to ask for permission on this because he can keep his side of the bargain through an executive order. Do you know what would have happened had he gone to Congress at this point?
Well, of course, that is the question. Again, looking at the way things were going in the direction that things were heading, and Congress, of course, discussing additional sanctions. And even now, we're expecting to see some sort of action, whether it's in the form of hearings, whether it's in the form of a call from Congress for additional oversight. There's discussions on Capitol Hill. And, of course, while the president has said to Congress, again, now is not the time for new sanctions, it technically is within the purview of Congress. They could start discussing that. He doesn't, you know, they don't have to ask his permission for that. Of course, you know, the key thing to keep in mind as well is the timeline here. This, for the first time, sets up a kind of deadline, if you will, where if there are critics on the Hill that can make the case that Iran has not complied with the terms of the agreement, the pressure for additional action becomes even stronger.
Well, Secretary of State John Kerry has said this was not an agreement based on trust, but on verification. Others have said, in essence, you know, we just sort of need to see how this plays out. What does that mean?
Well, what Kerry's saying is, look, Iran has agreed to kind of an unprecedented access, at least for Iran, to inspectors, that it's agreed to daily inspections of some weapon sites and other measures which would allow for verification. You know, the president and others saying, look, we understand, the White House releasing a statement yesterday also saying, look, we understand Israel has reason to be skeptical of Iran's intentions here, that others have reason to be skeptical of Iran's intentions. And so verification and the inspections by international inspectors and the allowing the access for international inspectors is a big part of this agreement, and that's something you can expect to see the administration pointing to many, many times in the weeks and months ahead.
Now, we just heard in the top of the hour headlines from NPR that Israel will be sending delegates to Washington to talk about what they'd like going forward with Iran as they move forward looking at a deeper nuclear deal. Do you have a sense of what they'll be asking for and what their priorities are?
Of course, you know, the president spoke to Prime Minister Netanyahu on Sunday after the agreement was announced. The Prime Minister, of course, speaking out before he and the president had connected, expressing his disappointment with the deal. This is not what he wanted to see in the slightest. The president also said, made it clear, and the administration made it clear, that communication with Israel about disagreement, the terms of the agreement, the inspections under the agreement was going to be continuous now that it had been announced. You know, these talks, we're now learning, of course, were going on for many, many months, even before there was public awareness that they were taking place, that the process had begun. And so apparently, you know, Israel came to some awareness of this, they were saying. Representatives of the Israeli government were saying that they'd come to some awareness of this, even though it was not revealed to them officially for some time.
Now, this deal has an expiration date of 6 months. You know, in the meantime, what kind of oversight will weapons inspectors have in Iran?
Again, that's the key. You know, under the terms of this agreement, there would be at some point daily inspections involved. There will be access for international inspectors, and they will be given free access to the two reactors in particular that were in question. And that's going to be a huge, huge part of the president and the administration's case as they're heading to Congress now. You heard John Kerry say it's trust and verify, 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 repeating that again and again and again, making the case that the administration is not just taking Iran's word on faith, that it is looking at actual facts on the ground, that there are experts there who are able to gauge whether or not Tehran is in compliance with the terms of the agreement. Because, again, the key for the administration is not just looking ahead to the possibility of a permanent agreement in 6 months, but preventing any additional action from being taken before then. Anything that happens before then, any additional measures that were taken, any punitive measures against Iran, they say would weaken their hand when they go to the negotiating table because it would make the case to Tehran that they might not be able to deliver on their side of any kind of permanent agreement.
And it's possible, isn't it, that this could just draw out 6 months by 6 months, eking along without maybe ever getting as far as certain parties would like it to go?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and that's the other key here. But of course, you know, a lot of people saying, the people who are defending the agreement would say, look, you know, at least there's a process in place now, and that any kind of continuing diplomatic process, even if it's slow and painful, will be preferable to military action. And, of course, some critics worrying that the momentum could be lost for stronger action if there is this kind of slow, painful movement forward that's apparent. It's interesting, so we'll see how it plays out over the next few months. The dynamic that develops, the sense of whether Iran is being completely forthcoming, the sense of whether inspectors have all the access that they need to verify that Iran is in compliance, that's going to be a huge part of what we can expect to see at the end of the six-month period.
Well, obviously the brass ring here is an Iran without weapons capabilities, whose program is only used for peaceful purposes. How close do you think we are to grabbing that ring at this point?
And that's the $64,000 question. I mean, you know, no one seems to really know that. Again, even the administration, as it's plugging this deal and saying that they're going to be moving forward and continuing the conversation with Iranian officials, saying, again, Israel and others have much reason to be skeptical of Iran's stated intentions. So the early signs, or at least, you know, the fact that Iran has agreed to halt the production of the weapons-grade uranium is seen as a huge step, or at least a sign of good faith. So at least for the time being, for the next several months, that program is essentially frozen in place, which the administration believes will be the case, or at the very least, it will slow down their progression towards weapons. So, again, remains to be seen.
All right. Well, Rebecca, thank you so much for joining us.
And thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Rebecca Cinderbrand, Deputy White House Editor for Politico.
Now we'll check the headlines. Then we'll be back with a neuroscientist who was studying brain scans of psychopaths when he made a startling discovery. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret.
In October of 2005, neuroscientist James Fallon was searching through brain scans of psychopaths and other abnormal brains when he made a surprising discovery.
Until then, Fallon believed that our genes mainly determine our behavior. What he found that day muddied the waters a bit.
James Fallon joins us now. His new book is called The Psychopath Inside, a neuroscientist's personal journey into the dark side of the brain. James is a professor of psychiatry and human behavior at the University of California, Irvine School of Medicine. And James, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me, Veronica.
You've been looking at brain scans as part of your research, in particular the brains of serial killers, in this instance, psychopaths, and a handful of other abnormal brain types. What does the brain of a psychopath look like?
Well, the consistent underlying pattern looks like, and it's not just from those that I had been studying and reported on, but recently other people have found the same thing. And so far it looks like it's a reduction of activity, neural activity, in the part of the prefrontal cortex over the eyes. It's called orbital because it's over the orbits, and also called ventromedial. That's all right next to each other. And also there was a lower activity in the amygdala at the end of the temporal lobe. And these two connect to make a big C in the brain of structures. And this is the emotional brain or limbic system. And these were all pretty much turned off. And in addition, the area, another part connecting them, it's called the insula, showed a patchiness that was very abnormal, and that has to do with, that area has to do with empathy. So it's those areas of the brain that are involved in ethics, morality, controls of impulse, but also kind of your animal desires and your the type of empathy you have or don't have. Those areas were really abnormal in all these psychopaths and many of the murderers.
And so you see a brain like that, you see these areas of the brain that are maybe shut down, and you think, okay, this is a profile of the brain of a psychopath, right?
Well, it's the profile of the brain of somebody who probably has those traits. And so people who have this pattern may not be psychopaths, but they probably will have the traits of the impulsivity, kind of devil-may-care. They will lack a certain kind of empathy. That is, they'll have many of the traits, but perhaps without being a categorical psychopath. And so, I mean, if you see this pattern, and when I've seen it in people, you can kind of tell how they behave. But it doesn't mean you can't tell they're a criminal, and you can't tell they're a categorical psychopath. But you know some of their behaviors for sure.
All right. Well, and some of these people include, you, as a matter of fact. You were looking through these and you got a shock. Tell us what happened.
Well, you know, I guess in everybody's life, Gandalf shows up at the door and plays a trick. And the problem is I played a trick on myself. It was purely by serendipity. And as I was at the end of analyzing all these murderers' brains and psychopaths and was starting to give talks, I just happened to be doing a parallel study in the lab on genes that are associated with Alzheimer's disease. And we had finished all the patients, and we were looking for controls, more controls. And we're doing genetic studies and the PET scans. And so I asked my family if they want to be involved because we needed normals. But also we hadn't done a family, and especially my wife's mother and father died of Alzheimer's. She had a lot of it in the family. And so I asked her, do you really want to know? And, you know, maybe you don't want to know if you have the genetics and the beginning patterns of this, even though you're normal now. And she said yes. And this was a key thing that happened. And, in a way, I don't know if I wish she would have said yes, because this opened up everything. So I blame this on her, basically. You know, so And so we did it, and the scans came back, and I went through them, and I had a pile of all the murder scans and the psychopaths on the table on my office. And the technicians brought the scans in. They said, here's your family scans. There's a whole pile of them. And I looked through very quickly. You know, we had it coded so there were no names on anything. I like to do these blindly. And I looked normal, normal, normal. And I was so relieved. I got through, you know, all the way through the pile just about. And everybody looked normal. It didn't look like Alzheimer's, because I've seen a lot of Alzheimer's patients' brains and PET scans. But I got to the last one, and I flipped it over, and I said, and I told the technician, I said, this one is in the wrong pile. This should be in the murders pile. It's clearly mislabeled. And they went back to the PET machine and rechecked and rechecked. They come back, no, it's your family. I mean, at that point, I had to tear off the label, and it was me. And it was, the technician and I looked at each other. We just started to laugh. We kind of got the joke, and it was on me. But I just kind of laughed it off and really didn't get the rest of the genetics done for a while because we were so busy with this adult stem cell company I was setting up and these other studies. I kind of laughed it off because I thought to myself, I'm not a psychopath. I'm not a killer, rapist. And then after I got the genetic studies, the same thing came back. I had like 15 of the genes that are associated with aggression and violence in psychopathy, as well as many of the 15 or so ones related to low empathy.
And then did you start to put it together a little bit and say, you know, maybe I do have some of these traits?
Well, Veronica, after the genes came back, I had two parts of the biology were there. You know, there was a brain connectivity pattern that was associated with psychopathy, clearly, and the genetics. But still, I didn't take it seriously until, you know, I work with a lot of psychiatrists and who know me intimately in my behavior and geneticists. And we went through everything, and I started to ask them. I said, I'm not a psychopath, am I? Then the floodgates opened up. And they said, well, we've been telling you for many years that your behavior is psychopathic. And, you know, Veronica, I just said, well, that's like when somebody calls you crazy, you kind of blow it off. You're crazy. You know, you laugh it off. But they said, over the years, they listed all of these things I had done, and they agreed that I had all these psychopathic behaviors. I never was listening to this because I didn't see it all at once. You know,
so they made the case that, yeah, in fact, you did exhibit some of these behaviors that psychopaths have. But on the other hand, you've never murdered anybody. You're not a rapist. So why do some people have that brain and those genes, and they go out and they murder somebody, and why didn't you?
Well, this is the great question. In thinking about this, I finally was sitting in my jacuzzi. My mother was here. She's like 96 at the time. She's 90. And she was, you know, pruning our plant. She loves to do that in the garden. And she was sitting on this three-legged stool. And I looked at it, and I looked at her, and I said, Jesus, that's it. Now, you know, my life growing up in my family was incredibly good. And I looked at my mother, and, you know, and I realized that she had had, before me and after me, like 7 or 8 miscarriages. So after my oldest brother was born, it was like 5 years, then I was born, and then 4 more years before the next one. So I was like the next brother. And I was the middle of this, so I was always treated like the golden child. And I was by not only my parents and siblings, but also by my aunts and uncles and grandparents and their friends. It was just quite extraordinary. And you could see it in all the pictures. And I went back and looked at the movies. I was happy as a lark. And it was because of, you know, the way I was treated. And
you were loved.
I was absolutely loved. And I think my mother instinctively knew that. She also saw me at right at the time, and she just told me this. This was just a year and a half ago. I was writing the book, so this is something quite surprised me. And she told me that I went through this extraordinary dark period around puberty. And she was going to get a psychiatrist for me and all this, tell my father, but she didn't. I think she just told my teachers and other people to watch this guy, you know, make sure he doesn't get into trouble and everything. But, you know, Veronica, frankly, I was like, I'm, you know, 6 foot, I was athletic, like 210 pounds, and really got along with people. And so I was very social and athletic, and nobody ever bothered me anyway. And I was never subjected to anything that could be considered bullying or abuse. And I said, that's it. I said, I have all these genes. And I found out I had another allele for a serotonin transporter, that and this was another key. And that I write about in the book because it was so important, that I have this one. And it was thought to be one of these warrior genes that put you at risk for violence and everything. That's only if you're subjected to early abandonment or abuse, especially in the first few years of life.
So to cut to the chase, long story short, it's not necessarily just our brains and our genes. It's the environment.
Yeah, this was embarrassing for me personally, because I had been like the poster boy to my colleagues about being genes are everything. And I had to eat crow. I had it wrong. And once I saw how genes and environment and the timing of it in specific ways, it turned me upside down. So it was embarrassing professionally, but enlightening for me. And sometimes you got to just, eat it.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. It's a fascinating story. James, thank you so much for joining us. We've been talking to James Fallon, professor of psychiatry, and his new book is called The Psychopath Inside, A Neuroscientist's Personal Journey into the Dark Side of the Brain.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a look at the Obamacare rollout. We'll take a historical view, seeing how it compares to Social Security and Medicare when they were launched.
That's all coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Still to come today on Central Time, it's Wisconsin Life with a look at Native American food traditions. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're kicking off a week-long Wisconsin Life series on food today in celebration of Thanksgiving. In our first installment, we're talking about Native food traditions. For the Oneida Nation, corn isn't just food, it's culture.
The Oneida grew white corn for centuries in New York and replanted it along with their culture in Wisconsin in the 1820s. And every fall, the Oneida harvest their traditional white flint corn for sustenance and to remember that tradition.
Vicki Cornelius and Kyle Wisneski work with the Oneida Community Integrated Food Systems Project. They share their story in this installment of Wisconsin Life.
My name is Vicki Canarius, and I'm the Canary Food Processing Supervisor. My ancestors moved here in 1822, and they brought white corn with them from the state of New York. We were part of the Iroquois Confederacy, our Five Nations. Historically, it goes all the way back to our creation story when Sky Woman fell, and she had a daughter, and then when the grandmother passed away, they say the corn grew from her breast, that's why it's milky, and the squash and the beans grew from her body. And those are our main foods to sustain our people, what we call the three sisters, Asanade Gundahundel. We connect the women to the three sisters to do this dance that we call Old Woman's Dance. We have social dances that you do in public. Well, the Old Woman Dance is one of the ones we don't do out in public. It's only done during the ceremonies. Because they say women, we have the breast milk to feed our children, while the corn at its milky stage is also, we call, kind of the milk of the corn. And we have a ceremony called Green Corn Ceremony. And then we have our harvest ceremony. And then in the winter time, we have our midwinter ceremony. So we have many ceremonies. All our ceremonies are about being grateful for everything we have and reminding us of that connection to creation and to the earth.
Yeah. We had like to twist the corn around and then pull it and then stomp on the stem where it was on.
Sometimes pulling the
thing off the corn, it was hard because it got stuck on the stem.
I had to like twist it and pull it, and sometimes I had like step on the corn husk.
Are we on the radio or something?
My name's Kyle Wisneski, greenhouse technician. This is a final stage before we go and dry the corn. We husk it down with the three strongest husk, called lopping it off. We lop off that big long cob piece there. Excuse my colleagues here, but what we do is we get 65 cobs, braid it onto one braid there, and then we bring it into our corn shed where we hang it over winter. That's right down here. We usually do about 250 braids a year, and they have to hang in there for 3 to 4 months before it is processed into human food.
It's a product that you can store for years and years. I've heard of a guy storing and hanging white corn braids for up to 7 years and then planting it and seeing if it still grew, and it did. I've heard of nations in the Iroquois having up to 1 million bushels of corn in storage at one time historically. So it's our new healthy fast food or Oneida food, I call it.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. This episode was produced in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org.
Jeff Metoxin joins us now to share more about other Native food traditions. He's the director of the Junhequa program for the United Nation of Wisconsin. Jeff, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you very much for this opportunity and chance to share some of the stories and what our program strives for.
Well, let's start with that. The Junhequa program for the United Nation, what do you do there?
Our program is trying to be an educational model on sustainability for the community members. We look at our agricultural component as well as the cannery component, a place where our community members can come learn about the gardening process, the white corn that we have here that's been talked about during our annual harvest and husking bee. We also have grass-fed beef, poultry with our chicken layers as well as the broilers that we process on site. And then those particular garden products that can be processed, our community cannery is open to the public. An appointment is required, and they can contact them, and they'll work them through the steps of how to can their salsa or green beans, pickles, their applesauce, a variety of products.
All right. So this sounds like this isn't just sitting in a classroom here. This is actually some hands-on work, right?
Yes, that's correct. A big part of what our program is striving for is how can we help the people see that they have a choice when it comes to their meals, so that whether they want to get into a garden or they want to get into a very small container gardening, as well as processing. Say they aren't able to garden, but they do pick their own apples, and they get a bushel, and they want to process that into apple pie filling or apple sauce. The cannery strives, and Vicky's our supervisor. She was just talking about the white corn. Mm-hmm. She actually will have them come in, and she'll show them how to use the equipment. So it isn't a place really where someone would just kind of stop in and look. Both agriculture and cannery, we work very hard to show them these steps, share with them our successes as well as our challenges, and how can we help you make those decisions and better choices for your meals.
Let's get into that white corn that we just heard about. What once you're done processing it there, what do people do with it?
A lot of times, once we have it off the field, we're looking to get it to a drier stage. Our particular white corn, it has always had a high moisture content, so you do have to be aware of the proper drying techniques. So what we look for is probably like many other grains, but from a traditional practice, we want to dry it down in air circulation. We're really not looking for light. You can use heat to dry it down, but for ourselves at this point, we're not doing it. We have a fan system, a drying system. And once it's down to at least, we're trying to target 12%, it's going to store at a fantastic level and last for a very long time. The best thing for us to store it at is in a freezer once it's down, because we have to shell it, winnow it, and then you have the ability. Vicky touched a little on how someone was able to save their braids and the corn under proper storage. You can make the soup out of it, the traditional cornbread. That's a traditional meal for us that's coming up on Thanksgiving. And then you can get the flour if you want to make the bread yourself. So there's a variety of products that you can make with the white corn.
And I understand you're working to be a kind of a seed saver for some of the traditional foods. What are you doing?
Things that we've been working on is how to find out what are some of the traditional, let's say, beans in the Three Sisters garden with the corn, beans, and squash. What are the beans that are traditionally we would plant? What are the squashes or pumpkins? And we try and work with some of the other families and individuals in the area. And it's been a work in progress for a very long time to do it properly. It's not really, we do not take the approach of we're going to have this vastly large agricultural area. We look at it as you have a lot of families and individuals planting their seed, sharing that seed. How do we take care of it and preserve it best so that we can pass that knowledge on and that those particular foods are going to be around?
So what else are you doing to educate people in the community to encourage them to grow their own food and have a sustainable home food production system?
At this point, what we do have is workshops that are basically available upon request. We've gone through some growing stages and pains that we used to have standard workshops, but trying to find out ones that people are going to attend and you have an attendance that's worth having it. So we actually do quite a lot of workshops for people that either come to the site. We offer tours and presentations. That's just part of the program services that we do have. And what we look at is how can we educate them, whether it's through an article in our tribal newspaper, which is called the Gully We Sucks, whether it's like these opportunities now, talking with them about our program. So we've been able to make contacts with a lot of education areas from grade schools to universities and a lot of entities, and just talking about what our program is working on. So we're constantly looking at what's the best way we can put our information forward, and how do we make sure that it's preserved and passed on.
And how many people come through there, through the agriculture part, through the cannery, seeking this kind of help?
Oh, that's a really tough number to place on. Obviously, during the harvest time, say, depending on what the produce is, it can start as early as June if they have products that they want to process at the cannery and then run until now, whether it's certain items that they've harvested and can store well and cold storage. Sometimes individuals pick up, like the white corn stores well. They've come in and they process through our cannery. The agricultural site, I'm not really talking as if it's nonstop busy in any area, but it's well enough that we generally ask for appointments so that our staff as well on all the sides are prepared to provide that tour or give that presentation so that no one really feels overwhelmed, and also we provide something that's going to benefit everyone. Those have been going rather well for us year after year, and as I mentioned, we're constantly looking at ourselves, how can we improve? You know, there's no perfect system. It's learning as and adapt as we go along, but making sure we don't lose our traditions or our culture in this process.
And I guess a big question is why? Why is it important to keep these food traditions alive?
One of the things that I think everyone always realizes is when they have an understanding of their particular culture and their traditions is, how do we pass it on? How do we ensure that our children and the other generations have that knowledge? It's been there. And Vicki had touched on it in our own creation story for the Oneida Tribe. It does talk about the white corn. It does recognize the importance of saying, how do you work with the environment? How do you work with your food? There's some excellent discussion points out there and research on the food as medicine. And we've seen very well how can we maintain our traditions and deal with some of the health issues that I think all people are addressing, but especially with tribal members, that when they have to deal with diabetes, that there is food out there. There is a lot of things that come from our natural environment that can help us in these areas, whether it's with stress, high blood pressure, so many things that we don't get so caught up in the today's world and technology that we lose that knowledge that has helped us in the past and helped us get stronger and survive.
And as younger people come through, are you optimistic? Do you see them picking this up and running with it after they go through the trainings there?
It's tough. It does both. At times, realistically, you talk with the students and you work with them, as I mentioned, maybe from the grade school, who are probably the best workers I've ever seen. The energy level's way beyond any of the adults and, you know, in the high school level. But just making that connection, it does feel good that, you know, you talk with the students, or maybe they return. They've talked about the harvest and husking bee. A big part of that during the October for our white corn is education days, and it is nice to see some of the grade school levels that return every year or may have been gone for you, and they remember what they were doing with the white corn and how they picked it, and they share those stories with their parents and teachers. So I'd rather be optimistic, and I am optimistic that we'll continue to strive to make an impact on them as well as their families.
All
and
right.
Touching base with their elders as well is how do we bring back those stories that they have and that knowledge so we can all learn. And
all right, Jeff, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for this opportunity.
That's Jeff Metoxin, director of the Junhequa program for the Oneida Nation of Wisconsin.
Coming up tomorrow in our Wisconsin Life Food Series, we'll learn about the Midwestern holiday tradition of Jell-O salads.
Next on Central Time, we'll check the headlines. Then we'll talk to our in-house tech guy, Kevin Trueblood, about the cloud.
This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, a look at why gas prices have gone down and your holiday plans.
First, we have some technology advice from one of our WPR experts. There's been a lot of talk lately about using the cloud for our technology needs, but what is the cloud? I suspect I'm often using it and not really aware that I am.
I suspect most of us are using it and are not really aware that we are, but Kevin Trueblood is here with us now to tell us all about it. He's an engineer at WPR and our resident Central Time tech guy. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right, so there's our big metaphysical question for you. What is the cloud?
Well, I was just joking before I came on here to describe it as like a big fluffy land filled with cotton candy and unicorns, but we could dream that. Now, when we refer to like the cloud, it's more synonymous with what we would call online or internet, just services that are not actually physically located in your house or place of work.
Okay, so I did a little bit of boning up for this, and it's a connection, a group of servers, right, that are offsite somewhere.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. It's not physically located there. So it could be multiple systems that back each other up, but basically it's a place for you to store something offsite that's accessible from more than one place. So you can access it from basically anywhere you have an internet connection, whether it's at home, it's at work, from your phone. It's just a way to, it's kind of synonymous for online or the internet.
What does the cloud give us that we didn't have before?
Well, it gives us a lot of backup capabilities. It gives us the ability to, you know, before if we wanted to back something up, we burned a CD or we put something on a floppy disk and sent it to our mother's house for safekeeping or something. but now we can save something off on the line or on in the cloud, and we have a copy somewhere else. And so let's say if you have a home fire or your computer crashes or something happens to your physical computer, you have a copy somewhere else.
What are some of the typical things that people use the cloud for these days?
Well, for a lot of collaboration and also just for ease of use, for being able to, like if you have a tablet, for instance, if you have like an iPad and you want to type documents on it, you can save something to a cloud service and then sit down at your desk and continue working on it without having to use a USB drive or some kind of means to physically walk it between the two devices. It allows you to easily store something offsite. So you can use it for like Word documents or you could use pictures. So like, for instance, when I take a picture, it automatically uploads to a service and I can go sit down at my desk and the picture I took on my camera phone is now available at my desk.
Now, as I understand it, there are cloud services that are free and paid cloud services. Is that right?
That's right. And actually some of them that are free, you can also then pay for if you wanted to. Most of the free services, and there's a whole list of them, the big ones being like Dropbox, Amazon has some, Google Drive, Box, Mega. All of these services will offer you a little bit for free, which for most people is enough. It's enough to store a handful of pictures and some Word documents and things. But then if you wanted to add more, like let's say you wanted to put your entire family history of pictures on their service, then you'd probably want to pay for it. And then you get more space and you get more ability to store stuff.
Now, so let's take that example, your entire family photo collection. Will it be there forever and ever? Is it safe?
Well, it depends on who you ask. The answer is, you know, many of these companies offer encryption services. So they ensure that that your data is definitely secure. It's protected. But the reality is some of them have been hacked in terms that people have gotten access to it. Typically, it's through stealing their password or figuring out what their password is and then getting in through those means. But for the most part, it is safe. I mean, when you talk about the handful of instances where somebody's data has been compromised, that's compared against the hundreds of millions of accounts and files that are stored on their service. So the chances are pretty slim.
Okay. And what about, you know, conceptually, we have our computers in constant contact with whatever server is storing our stuff. So does that mean, I mean, you're seeing a little bit of hacking going on now. Do you expect to see more of it down the road if we're not, you know, keeping control of that little CD or hard drive ourselves?
Sure. Well, and that's entirely possible. You know, one of the best tips of that I've read about these services is to not put things on them that you would feel vulnerable to having it stolen. In other words, you know, if you want to save your college report, you know, some major report or something that you're working on for work, that's great. That's what it's there for. But storing bank documents, maybe that's not the best place to put it, and save something like that locally where others, it's harder for somebody to get into.
Now, the cloud has been a major buzzword or words for companies, tech companies, for going on, you know, a year or two now. What did they get out of it?
Well, they get a lot of flexibility. The biggest thing now is we do a lot of telecommuting. People are working off-site, they're working from home, or you have multiple offices around the country. And what we refer to as the cloud gives companies the ability to store their data in off-site locations, not only for backup, but also it makes it easier for people to then access their data. So they can get to it from their house, and when they save it, suddenly, you know, somebody in two states away can either see it right away, or in some cases, they can collaborate with them. They can actually have the same document open at the same time and be working and typing on the same thing at the same time, which can be a little weird to look at sometimes.
Like in Google Drive, for instance.
That's exactly right. That's one of the most famous ones for doing just that. And now Microsoft is expanding into that as well. They're going to start offering their Office suite online, similar to Google Drive.
Now, do you think everyone has fast enough internet connections to use the cloud right now?
Well, if you have broadband internet, anything even beyond dial-up, yeah, you shouldn't have any problems. But even if you have a dial-up system, what a lot of these services like Dropbox do is they synchronize your files whenever you're online. So if you open and create and type a long paper or something and then save it, as soon as you get online, it will then automatically upload it to their website where it's available anywhere else you want to have the internet connection. So it's not necessarily that you have to be on all the time to get to whatever you're working on.
It's great to have these huge mega warehouses of storage that are not, you know, located, say, in your backyard or someone's backyard. But is there a limit to this?
As far as size?
Storage or? And the number of things that people can store?
Well, I mean, you can think of them as, you can think of them just as a separate hard drive, a separate place to store them. And most of these companies will give you as much as you really want to pay for. And that can be a considerable amount of money, especially for bigger businesses. But if that's the way you want to operate, if it's valuable to you, then you probably pay for it.
So you mentioned not putting your sensitive bank documents on there. Maybe you can put your photos up there. Are there other safe computing tips that you want people to know about when they're trying to use the cloud?
Well, they're very similar to using other online services. And last time I was here, a time or two ago, when I had mentioned about how you can get hacked, one of the things you want to keep in mind is use a unique password for all your different services.
That's because, so much work.
Well, it is. But at the same time, though, if somebody, for services like Dropbox, your username is your email address. And then if you have the same password as your for Dropbox as you do for your email, say it's Google Mail or whatever, well, if they have your username and password for Dropbox, well, they've also got your email password as well. So that's why it's very highly recommended to use unique passwords for each different service that you use. And like you said, just be careful about what you put up there. If somebody wants to find your photos of your grandma, then okay.
Well, you know, in our last seconds here, any new developments or cutting edge things on the horizon with the cloud?
Well, they're just getting, there's more and more services that are coming out there, and all of them have advantages and disadvantages. And you can certainly use more than one. If you want to have a Dropbox and also use another one called Spider Oak, which is, from what I can tell, one of the ones that gets the better reviews for being the most secure. You can certainly use more than one and then use it for different tasks. So there's just more out there and they're getting cheaper.
All right. Well, Kevin, thank you so much for being our oracle about the cloud today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Appreciate it. That was Kevin Trueblood, WPR engineer and a resident tech expert.
Coming up, we'll look at the story behind lower gas prices and check out your holiday travel plans. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.